On this episode of Video Culture, we'll talk fake heroes, real danger with Three Amigos, and Galaxy Quest. Never give up, never surrender.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills, there will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And welcome to another episode of Video Culture. I'm your host, Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And we've got two funny movies this time, two comedies, and two beloved comedies that I think have a sort of a cult following, one kind of just general sort of mass appeal, at least from our childhood, and then one also that has a huge cult following in Galaxy Quest.
Mm-hmm. And the one from our childhood is, of course, Three Amigos, which I don't know about you, Ryan, but I watched constantly on HBO as a kid.
It was, I mean, it was one of those shows that because it's just so, you know, there's not a lot of bad things in it per se. I mean, it was on a lot of television shows. There wasn't a lot of editing that it needed, so it could be on USA, on TBS, on WGN. And it was constantly on. It's just a good, almost like family comedy, yeah. Even though that it is kind of like has these Western elements where these, you know, guys are getting shot and killed, you know?
Yeah, it's sort of like Rio Bravo where the guys just kind of grab their chests and fall over.
Right. Or like so the guys just die in the bar and the bartender's like, okay, just like scoops, you know, just kind of wipes them away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a little bit of adult humor is in the movie, and it does have some adult humor. It's all very subtle.
Mm-hmm.
So kids wouldn't get it, you know? But it's there, but it's not the kind of thing that would just fly right over their heads.
Well, and then also, so let's just go ahead and start talking about Three Amigos since we already are on the topic. It stars, the Three Amigos being Martin Short, Chevy Chase, and... why is his name escaping me? I have the notes in front
Steve
of my
Martin.
Head. And Steve Martin. I was thinking Martin because it's like Steve Martin Short. That's what I want to say.
It all just kind of ran together for you.
They play these like sort of like early 1900s, early Hollywood, sort of singing cowboy or kind of
silent film stars who their shtick is they're cowboys basically.
Yeah. So. The synopsis on IMDb is very short, so I'll just read it right quick. Three out-of-work silent movie actors are accidentally drawn to a Mexican village that is being harassed by a gang of outlaws. Three, Ned, Lucky Day, and Dusty Bottoms, play Lone Ranger types in movies, but must play their parts for real now. So this is just like a common concept where they're the fake... you know, guys, but like they get mistaken as for real and then they get roped into doing some performance, but then they realize that like, this is not a performance. This is actually for real and they can get for real shot and they can get for real killed. And this isn't just, you know, joking around like we're entertainers.
It's a super simple concept and it's such a fun, light film, but let's talk about the cast. Let's start there. You've got Martin Short, who is an alumni from the show because he was in Interspace.
Yes.
Who is delightful.
Yeah, but I mean, who's from SCTV, This mm-hmm. is one of this is his first major Hollywood film, but yes, he's gone on and done so much more from this point forward. You know what I mean? Yeah. And Chevy yeah. Chase being from, you know, Fletch and from Saturday Night Live. And, of course, Steve Martin, who's been in, you know, everything from Parenthood to The Jerk to Father of the Bride.
And Roxanne and yeah. all these really great comedies. It's really a murderer's row. You can't ask for really three better comedic leads of a 1980s film than this.
No, and they each have their own sort of unique personality where, you know, Martin Short plays this like where he was a kid actor, you know, that's that, you know, now he's like an adult actor. And this is what he's kind of, you know, made it as because they kept yeah. talking about like Little Ned movies or little, you know.
Yeah.
And Chevy Chase kind of plays, you know, kind of like the guy who's there, but he just doesn't really know what's going on. Not the brightest light in the room, yeah, you know.
He's the dumb one. Every group's yeah. got a dumb one, and that's Chevy Chase.
You know? Yeah, and Steve Martin kind of being the ringleader of it all is Lucky mm-hmm. Day, you know. But Chevy Chase, yeah. like his character name, has one of the best names. Is Dusty yeah. Bottoms. I love it.
Yeah. Well, and Steve Martin, his name is Lucky Day, which is a great name, and then Ned Niederlander, which is yeah, those are great names. But yeah, let's talk about some other people who are in the movie just briefly. Like it's got Joe Mantegna as the studio head, who's mm-hmm. he's got a great scene with Phil Hartman at the beginning. It's always so nice to see Phil Hartman in these things. I always forget when Phil Hartman is in stuff, and then suddenly he pops up, and it's like, oh, it's Phil Hartman.
Yeah,
yay.
Yeah, Phil Hartman and John Lovitz, too. That's Saturday true.
Yeah,
Night
John
Live
Lovitz,
alums.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, anything to get, you know, more Saturday Night Live alums, you know, into a scene as possible is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I love the scene where the three amigos try to demand more money from the studio, and the studio is just like, you're basically slaves, and they just throw them out of the studio.
Yeah, I mean, he goes from, like, singing their joys to, like, you know, they demand more money, and he's like, no, you know, and just,
yeah,
you're out of here.
Take the amigos' clothes quick. Yeah. And like, you gave us these clothes. You can't just take them. Yep. Yeah, it's so absurd, but it's so funny in, like, a gentle way.
Right. It was one of those things where, the studio heads just basically ran everything, and it's like, you need the studio more than the studio needs you kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, it's making fun of a pretty dark time in Hollywood. There was a time when actors were basically like indentured servants to studios where they didn't have a whole lot of free will or say so in their careers. They basically were kind of owned by the studios.
Exactly. They couldn't do films for other studio houses. They signed contracts for, you know, Columbia or Paramount, and that's who you did a movie with. You didn't go out and do everything else.
Yeah, that was basically your career.
You didn't have an agent. You couldn't do advertisements or appearances if it wasn't for the studio.
Yeah. You know? So basically they get thrown out of the studio and they end up getting a telegram from Mexico from a person who they think wants them to put on a show. Mm-hmm. But in actuality, it's from this town that's being terrorized by a group of criminals led by a guy named El Guapo, which in Spanish means the handsome.
yes, it does.
Which always amuses me.
Yeah.
And, so they're being terrorized by El Guapo, and they basically see the Three Amigos movies and don't realize that they're movies. They think they're like documentaries or something.
Yeah.
So they hope that the amigos will come save them. But because of the truncated telegram, the amigos think they're going to be performing. So they go to this little dingy Mexican town. And it's like suddenly they go from being in like this kind of vaudeville type world to suddenly being in like Rio Bravo, you know? Mm-hmm. Or like a very sanitized spaghetti western scenario.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a half Nacho Libre, half kind of Rio Bravo, you know, kind of situation. Yeah.
Yeah, like the look of everything is very spaghetti western, but like the vibe of it is kind of gentle. Like there's no like blood or overt violence. When people get shot, they just kind of fall over.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still kind of they do the close up thing of like spaghetti westerns. Everyone looks kind of dingy.
Mm-hmm.
It's got kind of that vibe to it.
Yeah, but I mean And really, with all of the gags of it all, you know, they get caught in this moment of, you know, do they continue doing what they're doing? They have to, you know, search within themselves, or are they going to do the right thing and help this town out, because they actually make things worse for them, you know, by being there, by trying to pretend, and then, you know, they go to save themselves and make things worse, and then they have to, you know, go, okay, well, we have to, you know, put everything aside. We don't have anything to go back to. Hollywood doesn't want us. So, you know, let's help this town out. And, it wound up, of course, it like winds up, you know, working out in their favor, along with all the rest of the jokes. But yeah, I mean, it's just, you're just along for like, how far are you going to go into this, you know, thing before they realize that it's, that they're in for it. You know what I mean? And then it's like, when you get caught into, okay, now they're in it, it's like, now you gotta, how are they going to get out of it? You know what I mean? So that's what I think like keeps you on the hook the whole time. And the guy playing El Guapo was so great. Alfonso Aru. I mean, he was in Used Cars and Romancing the Stone, and he was such this charismatic, you know, really smiling, like really just kind of outlandish sort of guy. Yeah. When you first see him, you know, the guys come up, you know, and say, hey, there's these gringos in the town. And you know, El Guapo is in the middle of like taking a picture, like a portrait, like he's doing this like photography thing where he's like trying to make it look like they're all in the Middle East or something. It's like, it's really weird.
Like he's just trying to like indulge in his hobbies, you know? He likes to take pictures.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he likes to play games. And like when he first meets the three amigos, they're, you know, dancing around and they're kind of like putting on a show, and he's like kind of smiling. He's like, I like these guys, you know?
Yeah. So these are funny guys.
Yeah.
Just shoot one of them. Which is one of my favorite jokes in the entire movie. Just kill one of them.
Right. But that's when they realize that, like, oh, they have real pistols. And, you know, Lucky Day gets mad. It's like, I'm going to turn you into the Union, you know, and you're using real bullets. That's when they kind of realize that it's real. But, yeah.
It's so unprofessional. So unprofessional.
Yeah. But, I that's my favorite part of the movie, is just El Guapo himself as a character.
He's so charismatic. He's so funny. And he's got all the good dialogue. Like, growing up, me and my sister quoted the plethora.
Oh, yeah, the plethora.
To each other. We did that all the time.
Do I have a plethora?
Now, El Guapo, I, Jefe, am not as smart as you.
Jefe.
Yeah.
It is a Jefe? It's spelled J-E-F-E, but it's pronounced Jefe.
It's Jefe, which is Spanish for boss.
Yeah, it is, which is weird because
he's the henchman.
He's kind of like the second guy in command or whatever.
Yeah. So one thing I've always liked about Three Amigos is it's kind of a stealth musical. It's got some really great musical numbers written by Randy Newman. Mm-hmm. And I love every musical number in the film.
Yeah, I mean, they do the whole like My Little Buttercup scene, like in the bar. There's a couple moments, I think, like in the movie too, that almost get sort of parody, like almost like kind of cartoonish, or like what I call airplane movies, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where it gets like a little too far fetched, but yeah, the musical numbers are, because I think part of the reason why they're so entertaining is they're so out of place.
Yes.
You know, they're walking into this like cantina and they're doing this like, you know, Broadway show kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Well, and part of it is Steve Martin and Martin Short are such good song and dance men to begin with.
Yeah.
Like they're so good at that kind of stuff. They really nail those scenes.
Well, and, I mean, that's how he became an entertainer. It was standing around, you know, crowds and playing, you know, banjo and doing rope tricks. So the rope tricks that he's doing are like real rope tricks, you know, that he learned how to do. I mean, that was his thing. I was surprised that he didn't like talk the producers into like playing banjo or something like that. You know, I was knowing what we know now about, you know, Steve Martin and him following his passions and music and really kind of having a like an Americana career. basically out of playing banjo and playing music. I'm surprised that he didn't, but maybe he just didn't think it was a place or, whatever. I know that I'll get into the notes, but he had the idea for doing this movie since like 1980. And so I think that he was just happy to just get something done and get it on film.
It really feels like it has the sensibility of his stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
For anyone who's not familiar with Steve Martin's stand-up, it's very absurd and kind of out there. Even nowadays, it's very... If he was a stand-up who was practicing now, he'd be considered an alternative comedian. His stuff is very kind of avant-garde, but silly.
Mm-hmm. Like the whole King Tut thing and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Well, just the idea of just, I could quote his bits, but it's if that's like structured like regular stand up, but it's really left of center. It's weird and odd in different ways, in unexpected ways.
Right.
And I think the film has a lot of that quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's kind of straightforward, but it's just a little bit off to make it slightly surreal.
Mm hmm.
But so, I've been thinking about, the format of the show recently, Ryan.
Yep.
And I've come up with an idea that I want to try, I want to break out on this episode.
Okay.
It's called Rewind Fast Forward.
Okay.
So let's start with Three Amigos.
Okay.
What's one scene in Three Amigos that you would like to rewind and watch over again? What's a scene you would savor?
I love the scene where they meet El Guapo for the first time and they realize that like, oh, this is real. And they start crying. And he's like, I don't shoot crying babies. That's all like really absurd, that sort of thing. And that, I love that scene. That's like one of my favorite scenes. And the My Little Buttercup is always like fantastic too.
So for me, I mean, there's so many scenes that I really do just cherish from this movie, and I really love Ned's duel with the evil German.
Oh, with the German dude, yeah, where you have to like quick draw.
Yeah, that's one plot point we didn't go into. But there, for those who haven't seen the movie, there's a henchman of El Guapo who was basically a German. Who's there doing arms dealings with El Guapo?
Yeah, he's selling them, like, German arms, rifles, and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, and it turns out he knows who the Three Amigos are. He recognizes Ned because he's a fan of his films. And he's like, I wanted to be a quick draw artist like you because of your cowboy movies. But then I realized that movies are phony and you aren't really that fast. And so he basically challenges Ned to a duel. And it's this nice little dramatic moment in this really silly film. Mm-hmm. And it has a funny payoff. But the build-up to it is it's actually a good little bit of tense filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the scene of them handing Martin Short the Mexican pistol, and it's almost too heavy for him to lift, and he has to use both hands to put it in the holster.
Yeah, like falls straight to the ground.
Yeah. It's such a good bit of physical comedy. I mean, and again, I could literally name off 15 scenes that I think are great that I just love about Three Amigos.
Well, I think that you have three comedians in this movie that, number one, don't step on all three of them, right? They don't really like overstep each other's bounds. They're not trying to scene steal, I guess you would say.
Exactly, yeah. They give each other time to shine.
Yeah, exactly, which is amazing. The second thing is, I think that you have, they're really good, all three guys, like Steve Martin, Chevy Chase, Martin Short, are all three really good at that subtle intellectual humor, okay? Because we know Chevy Chase, like, he is the absolute perfect Fletch. But they're also really great at physical comedy.
Yes.
And Chevy Chase always, I mean, his physical comedy is always like a little more subtle, like when he's eating the burrito and like
it's falling out. I was about to bring that up. Yeah. Yeah. It's falling out. And then he has that pitch perfect line at the end. He goes, do you have anything besides Mexican food?
Yes.
And I swear, every time that scene plays, I have to stop the movie and literally laugh.
Yeah.
For a good minute and then turn it back on because that scene kills me every time.
Yeah.
It's such a great line delivery.
Exactly.
He nails it so perfectly.
Well, that is the whole movie. It is filled with all those little moments that just like build it up to just like one big performance. Now, to answer your question, I know where you're going.
Yeah.
Where the fast forward is, there's that scene where they make the decision and they're like, okay, we're going to go get El Guapo. We're going to go do this thing. And then they go out on this quest. And then it's like there's two scenes right after that, which like make zero sense in the entire movie that you can just like completely edit out, and like it would still make for a great movie. And that's the scene where they're camping out and they have that singing with all of the animals. Like Chevy Chase has his musical number, you know, where he's like the singing cowboy, but then all the animals come out, and then even the horses like start singing, and you're like, what is happening? Is this like a dream sequence or something? Like, this is weird. And then, you know, because nothing else in the movie is really sort of like supernatural. It just seems like very out of the element. And then the scene where they have like the singing bush and like they shoot the invisible guy.
Yeah, who's the singing bush and the invisible swordsman.
Yeah,
so, invisible swordsman. So the idea of the fast forward is, what scenes do you hate and which you would fast forward through if you had the option? And, I actually like this. I like the campfire scene. It really brushes up against being too much because I like the song. I'm okay with it. But yeah, I hate the singing bush invisible swordsman scene. Well, hate's a strong word because by itself, like if you chop that out and watched it, it's funny by itself.
Yeah,
but it doesn't fit into any of the rest of the film. It is completely out of left field. It has no bearing on the plot. I mean, literally, you could take that scene out completely, and the entire movie would still make perfect sense.
Yeah, it does feel very arbitrary. I do remember watching it as a kid and thinking how, you know, funny or stupid it is, because it's just one of those absurd things that happen. So I didn't really think anything of it at the time. But yeah, there was nothing else sort of like... like supernatural in the rest of the movie. Like everything else is very, you know, sort of practical, I guess you would say.
It just goes too far. I mean, that scene, like I said, by itself in like an isolated moment, it's fine. Mm-hmm. But in the whole of the film, it just goes too far into the fantastical. You know, it's too much.
Yeah, it is. I agree with you. But I have some notes about this movie and the way that it was edited, and I do know the one sort of spoiler I can sort of reveal is that, you know, it was directed by John Landis, who we talked about on the show, previously, because he did Into the Night, but he also did some other, you know, fantastic movies like Animal House, American Werewolf in London, Trading Places, Coming to America, Beverly Hills Cop 3, but he was in the middle of the Twilight Zone movie legal battles at the time.
Yeah, which is a really unpleasant thing, and let's not go into what that was all about, but let's just say that he was distracted during all of
it was just like a wrongful death suit of an accidental death suit that you know, he had to defend himself for, you know, because during the production because of a helicopter accident. But, you know, it was a tragedy. But, yeah, unfortunately, some decisions got made, I think, that were not really based on, you know, the director, that were more based upon what the studio, like, sort of wanted. Mm-hmm. But we'll get into the details of that a little bit later. Anyway, but yeah, in my notes, I usually only write like one or two notes for the movies, like, and I just kind of go with the discussion of where it goes, and the, you know, because I there's usually like one or two points that I want to make, and the only point that I you know wrote was, it's perfect in nearly every way except for the singing bush invisible man scene.
And to me, that's honestly how I feel about it. I sincerely adore this movie. And I mean, I grew up with it, and you have to think of nostalgia. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think it's such a, even trying to look at it objectively, I think it's so funny and well performed. And most of the jokes are very well written. I really think it's, I mean, I think it's a wonderful film that, that I love dearly.
Right.
And nostalgia aside, I think it's just good.
Yeah. I completely agree. I think it just, and I think it being in the middle and being in a lull point and being following also like that, that other singing, you know, it's kind of strange scene, which, you know, I think it's fine if you leave that in, but then like, I would say either keep one or the other, but if I would have to make my decision, I'd probably keep, you know, the music more because that more falls in line with, you know, kind of the scope of the film or like the genre of the film, you know, being like a cowboy movie because it shows them what they would be doing like on an actual like Three Amigos movie.
Yeah, that's the, it feels like suddenly they are the heroes they portrayed themselves to be.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, like they're living out the movie in real life kind of thing.
Yeah, but then you go, why is there an invisible swordsman? Why is this bush singing? Yeah. And it literally has no bearing on anything else. It's just, it's too weird.
Okay.
It just doesn't work.
All right, well, let's move on. Let's move on to Galaxy Quest. And this was a movie in 1999 that has had huge impact even today and has a huge cult following just due to the nature of this film and it being kind of like a real life Star Trek actors, you know, sort of movie. It's almost like you know, other movies where you have fictitious things, but then you have actual real events that they're sort of based on, and then you throw them all in a movie.
Well, you know? Let's just say that the plot of Galaxy Quest is very, very similar.
Yeah, extremely to Three Amigos. Similar. I watched Three Amigos first, I watched Galaxy Quest first, and then I watched Three Amigos, and I was like, the premise is exactly the same.
Mm-hmm,
like, they're actors, but then someone comes to them because they think they're real, and they say, hey, we have a threat. We really like how you do stuff. Can you come help us? Yeah. And they think that it's some sort of entertainment kind of show, but it turns out to be real.
Until it's too late and they're stuck in this situation, and then they have to be real heroes.
Yeah.
It's practically a sci-fi reboot of Three Amigos.
Yeah. Yeah, basically. It is. It's a Star Trek imagined version of Three Amigos, I guess, if you will.
And that's not to say it's not good, because let's hit it right away. Galaxy Quest is great.
Yeah. And I think that there's some other parts of Galaxy Quest because of, you know, just because of the characters being completely different. You know, in Three Amigos, they all liked each other and were friends, and they never really got on each other's nerves a whole lot. Mm-hmm. But in this movie, they are sort of at odds, you know, with each other a few times.
Well, it gives them more of an arc. It gives them a chance to grow and change. Outside of just becoming heroes, they also grow to care about each other.
Right.
So let's talk about the cast. The cast for Galaxy Quest is just as stellar as Three Amigos.
Oh my gosh. Tim Allen plays the main sort of like William Shatner character, right? Jason Nesmith. And here's the thing about these notes. Like, because they played two people, Tim Allen as Jason Nesmith and Commander Peter Quincy Taggart. And then Sigourney Weaver, you know, who we all, you know and love, and we've talked about Sigourney before from being in, I mean, and she was in Working Girl to, you know, Alien and Aliens, and she plays Gwen DeMarco, but Lieutenant Tawny Madison, you know?
Yeah, they play the actors, but they also play the characters the actors play.
Right, which is also hilarious to me, but then Alan Rickman, you know, isn't it? Tony Shalhoub?
Tony Shalhoub from Monk, and Alan Rickman is, of course, from Die Hard. He's Hans Gruber,
right?
One of the greatest actors and one of the greatest movie actors that ever lived, in my opinion.
And Harry Potter. I mean, Sam Rockwell, Daryl Mitchell. I mean, it's just full of, and also this is the first movie for, who was it?
Rainn Wilson. Yeah.
It was first, Rainn Wilson, but also Justin Long.
Oh yeah. Justin Long, who is, who was, of course, you know, was the Apple guy. You know, yeah. I'm a PC. I'm a Mac commercial.
Yeah, Dodgeball. He's just not that into you. Mm-hmm. Waiting. You know, the Mac guy. I mean, so yeah. I mean, but this was his very first movie as this like sort of Galaxy Quest super fan. You know, he's the guy who comes up to to Jason Nesmith and ask him like a super serious technical question about something. And
yeah, you know, as if the show's real. Yeah. Yeah. Like in episode 3, 5, whatever, you know,
how could you said to use this, but you know, when this is this part of the ship that doesn't really do that, you know, he's like, I don't know. It's a TV show. So yeah. Cause that's the kind of thing is like the actors, you know, sometimes see, what they do is like, I'm just doing, you know, my craft as an actor. And then, but these, you know, fans just like make this whole world, about it. And they just become like super fans about it. And sometimes like the actors don't really understand, you know?
Yeah. It matters more to the fans than it does the actors. That's pretty common, really.
Right.
For so many actors, so much of this is just a job.
Right. You know? I mean, and how many people like come up to Tim Allen and say Infinity and Beyond, or, you know, Never Give Up, Never Surrender. And I bet you he never hears Never Give Up, Never Surrender anymore, you know, or not that much. He probably hears, you know, To Infinity and Beyond more, you know.
Well, it's just all what's, you know, captured the cultural zeitgeist. And I mean, I think Toy Story is very big, but honestly, Galaxy Quest has really hung on and still is very popular as far as a pop culture thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still very beloved.
Yeah.
But let's talk a little bit about what happens.
And also, I love the aliens, the guy Enrico Colian.
Yeah, I don't know how to say his last name, to be honest. I don't know how to say his last name, to be honest with you.
The guy that played Mathazar, the leader of the Theremins. And the Theremins, I love that name, too. You got to admit, any audio guide like knows what a Theremin is. It's absolutely hilarious, which is like a super nerdy thing that like the Star Wars, theme song was played on a theremin, mm-hmm. you know, which is like this, it's kind of like a synthesizer, but it's played like with antennas. So as one hand gets close to it, like the pitch goes up, and on the one hand, when it goes up, like the amplitude goes up. So... yeah, so that woo, that's all, yeah. You know. If you watched an episode of like, what's that TV show? My mind is blanking.
I don't know, man. But yeah, you're right.
Big Bang Theory. On the Big Bang Theory, like Sheldon plays like a theremin, and he plays that's like true, the Star Trek theme on one of the episodes.
Yeah, but yeah, it is used for the Star Trek theme. I think that's where the reference comes from.
Yeah. I mean, Star Trek references, like, sort of tucked in into all of this, you know? Kind of the same way, I was thinking the same way that sort of, like, 007, references were, like, tucked into, Austin Powers. But this was definitely a riff on, you know, on Star Trek, for sure.
Yeah, well, what I think makes it, and not to compare that, but what makes it, to me, better and more enduring than the Austin Powers films is that Galaxy Quest loves Star Trek.
Yeah.
I mean, the love of Star Trek is evident in every part of it. Yes. The love of not just the show and the actors, but the fandom.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear that the people who made it cared a lot about Star Trek. I mean, like I've often said to people that I think Galaxy Quest is the best Star Trek movie. And I know that a lot of diehard Star Trek fans feel the same way. There's actually a fan vote at one of the large Star Trek conventions where they ranked all of the Star Trek films, and Galaxy Quest actually I think ended up in the top 5 best Star Trek movies. That's how beloved it is even by Star Trek fandom.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. Well, I think too now a lot of the truth has come out about you know what has happened and some of the stories that the actors like kind of talk about. Were like real, you know, like that actually like really happened to them in real life. You know, like the scene where Tim Allen, you know, Jason Nesmith is in the bathroom and overhearing like people talking about, you know, what a loser this guy is. And this is what he does now. He just comes and does these stupid, you know, conventions or whatever. And, you know, he's just like, oh, you know, that really happened to William Shatner in like 1989. And that's one of the reasons why, like, it's been really hard for him to, like, I think he's been back to a convention, but in like late, I don't know, but he didn't go to conventions for a really long time.
Well, I actually went to a convention that he was at one time. It was, I think it was a Dragon Con in Atlanta in 2009.
Okay.
And he had a massive line for signatures, and it was seriously impressive. Mm-hmm. Like, and he, you know how much he was charging per autograph? $100.
Yeah, I mean, I would believe it. And it's because the reason why is because he doesn't sign a lot of stuff. And he doesn't do a lot of stuff. And he's one of those guys that he's like, if he's out, he's like, don't bother me. You know, he's very sort of private because he just, you know, gets hassled. And I think maybe early on in his career, he kind of enjoyed the attention a little bit. And then, you know, later on in his career, he's like, you know what, this gets to be too much. And then people don't really like it or appreciate it. And, you know, whatever. I don't know. I don't want to psychoanalyze, like, you know, Bill Shatner. But, you know, you still have to live with that. And you still have to go, well, I'm that guy. That guy that everybody recognizes, and they know me as this, and everybody who's seen the show, they, you know, it's like, I am Captain Kirk, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's the same sort of idea here, that like all of these characters, they are those characters that they play on the show. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's one thing that separates it from Three Amigos, even though they are very similar, is there's a lot more sincerity to Galaxy Quest. Mm-hmm. Like there's more real emotion to this story.
Yeah.
Again, they fight the bad guys, and the bad guys strike back. Mm-hmm. But people actually get hurt in this film. Some people die.
Yeah.
And it's all played as very emotionally honest.
Mm-hmm.
So when there are sad moments, you legitimately feel sad for the characters. And so, I mean, you're more emotionally invested in what happens. It's not just that it's funny, and Galaxy Quest is very, very funny, but you really care about what happens in the story.
Yeah, like Alan Rickman's character, you know, Alexander Dane or Dr. Lazarus, you know, he has a famous line that everybody wants to hear. It says, by Grathbar's hammer, by the sons of Warvan, you shall be avenged. And, you know, he makes a big, you know, kind of pity party in the green room in the back. He's like, I'm not saying that line, damn it. You know,
it's stupid.
And it's stupid. This is all stupid. Why do I keep having to do this? And it's kind of like the same thing, like how musicians feel when they have to come out and they have to perform like the same song for a billionth time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the same hit song, like, oh, you just want to hear that one hit song that, you know, and it's like, he kind of feels the same way. Like, gosh, like, I don't want to, I don't want to like live through this. It's just, you know, boring, same old thing.
Yeah. And I'm tired of playing Freebird. Yeah.
Right. But then in the movie, you know, one of the characters like basically saves his life and steps in front of, you know, real fire and saves him. And so he, you know, and this guy is a fan too. And so he, you know, he says the line to him
And at that moment,
it's a heartfelt line, yeah.
Yeah, at that moment, he really believes it, and it means something to him again. And it's a very emotionally, I mean, it's super sad.
Yeah.
But it's emotionally satisfying. Like it hits you just right in that kind of, like, it gives you a little bit of a lump in your throat, you know?
Mm. Yeah, it does.
Of course, he crushes the scene. Like, Rickman is phenomenal.
Right. Yeah, because he realizes that, like, these people, like, their whole heritage is on the line. You know what I mean? Like, this is a whole planet.
Yeah.
Like, this is their way of life. This is their thing. Like, you know, I can go back to my, you know, whatever, and you know, back to and not really care. But then there are these really they're really being infringed upon. You know what I mean? I just also love how, like, no matter what these movies are, like, the whatever is like after them always looks like a bug. You know what I mean? Like, the alien, why do bad aliens always look like bugs or termites or something. Like, it's all.
So it's funny you mention that, because you know the designs for the aliens in the designs for the aliens in this, especially the bad guys, were done by Stan Winston, who did design the alien queen in Aliens.
I see.
So there is some insectoid, yeah. You know.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, DNA there.
Yeah, I knew that aliens like explain like the ducks, you know, joke that's in there. Why is it always ducks? You know.
Yeah. But yeah, the creature designs were done by the guy who designed the alien queen. So that's kind of why they look like insects, because they were done by the same artist.
Yeah, but I mean, even in like Star Trek, like movies and stuff, you know, like. You know, sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they, you know, look just like normal people or whatever. But, you know, sometimes like in movies like this, especially where it's like poking fun. Yeah, it's like it's really just kind of very outlandishly out there. You can definitely tell. The character looks exactly like, you know, a walking, talking, you know, termite.
Yeah.
And I think that's what they used as like a model for, you know, to use for it or whatever.
It's definitely got that quality to it.
Yeah. I do know like the practical effects. I mean, that was, they did have a lot of digital effects that were in it, but, you know, that character was kind of like a robotic creature or whatever that they used for it. And you can tell by the way, like the jaw worked and stuff like that, you know,
which to me is always more impressive than CGI. You mean, because it has a real weight to it. As we've talked about on this show before, practical effects will always feel more right to whenever you look at them, because they have a real sense of, you know, space and weight.
Yeah, but you can tell like that it even like kind of robotically, you know, sort of, it wasn't very natural sort of, you know, movement or whatever, but it was still very believable. Like, it drew you in, because most of the scenes that you see it, like, it's on like a screen, like a TV screen or something like that.
Yeah, anyway, they definitely work with the limitations of what they have.
Yeah, for sure.
So speaking of limitations and things that might not be so great, let's bring up again the fast forward and the rewind.
Uh-huh.
What moment in this film would you rewind and savor?
I don't know. That's really hard. That's a really hard one to digest. The scenes that were the funniest. I mean, the whole scenes with the fans and the interaction with the fans were the most fun to me. And then also like within themselves, like within they're in the break room, and then like when they're all like in the conference room and stuff like that, like those conversations that they all have with each other, like in private conversations, you can just tell they're like interacting and you know that's when they get to be themselves. Like, they don't have to be the actor, because they're really kind of playing like two roles, right? They're really like playing this one character, but then they can be like themselves, like behind closed doors or whatever. So that was always really that was kind of interesting to me.
For me, and again, much like with Three Amigos, there's lots of scenes in Galaxy Quest that I think are just the greatest. I mean, there's so much good in this film. There's very, very little bad. I would say there's arguably less bad about this movie than there was bad about Three Amigos. But if I had to pick just one scene that I really like that we haven't really talked about, there's one scene with Sam Rockwell's character, a guy who's not really part of the main crew. He sort of ends up in with the crew quite by accident, because, you know, he was an extra on the show. He was one of the guys who gets killed.
Yeah, crewman number six.
Yeah, what's commonly referred to in Star Trek lore as a red shirt, because the red shirts in Star Trek were always the guys who went to the planet first and got killed. They kind of set the plot into motion.
Right.
And at one point, he's panicking once the real adventure starts. He's like, I'm going to get killed. I'm going to get killed. I'm expendable. No one knows my last name. Do I even have a last name? And at one point, one of the characters reassures him. He goes, Guy, and how do you know you're not the plucky comic relief?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's and right.
And I always loved that. And I loved it, like his moment of realization that, oh, yeah, he could be the plucky comic relief and not the expendable guy.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a little meta bit of commentary that's got but again, it's got a real sincerity to it.
Mm-hmm.
And Rockwell is just so good at playing the realization that he might have a chance to live.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those movies that scenes that's funny. It's got real heart to it, and it's one of those really unsung moments of a movie full of great moments.
Oh yeah, for sure. I think because this is a new segment and I kind of caught off guard, and just sitting here thinking about it, like after a moment of we just had some technical difficulties, which we won't mention, but in thinking about it, I really loved at the end of the movie how the fans like got involved with also in the sort of rescue effort in the sort of help effort. Like Jason Nesmith, now is like relying on the fans for their technical knowledge, where he was like earlier in the movie, like making fun of them for all of their nerddom, and realizing that like, no, these guys are our allies. Like they love the show and they're the whole reason why we even exist and can do the things that we do. And he's like, they could really be an asset, for us at this time. And I thought that was really, really cool. And I think that shows, we're all nerds about something, right? We all nerd out about something. And, some people nerd out about, sports statistics, and some people nerd out about, fictional sci-fi TV shows,
Yeah.
And it's okay. You know what I mean? It's,
yeah. It all has value.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's one of my favorite things is like, seeing Justin Long, like kind of get involved in all that kind of stuff, and seeing him like, when he has like the communicator and he's like standing there in the parking lot, that's one of my favorite. That's whenever I, think about Galaxy Quest, I think about that scene.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that's one of the best things about the film is how it validates fan culture, like the positives of fan culture. It's one of the sweetest things about the movie, and it's one of the happier things about it to me is the way it kind of lovingly embraces fandom.
Yeah, it really celebrates it in a very unique way, for sure, I think.
Well, and here's the tougher question. And that's the rewind and savor.
Okay.
what about Galaxy Quest? Do you wish you could kind of fast forward through if given the option? If we allowed you to skip parts of the movie, which we don't here because we we've been watching the entire thing. If you were going to skip something, what would you skip?
I really didn't like the hard to watch scenes, right, where Quellac dies or where Jason Nesmith has to tell, the Mathazar the truth, because those really hurt, but those are like quintessential part of the story, I think. But the whole fighting the rock man, the rock character, I just thought was a little too ridiculous.
Yeah, it's funny because we've been on the same page for most of this, and I agree. The Rock Man fight is the worst part of the movie. The CGI is ugly. The design of the monster is really, really boring. Like it's like the most in a movie full of cool character designs and interesting things to look at. It's so bland and boring to look at.
Mm-hmm. And you could tell they're like in the middle of like Utah somewhere. Like they're not on a planet. They're in Utah. Like come on,
yeah,
guys.
Like it's not even well covered up. You're right, and that may have been intentional. It may have been a meta commentary on how they filmed the original Star Trek.
I think you're looking too deep in it.
I mean, it could be. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know.
But
I think the whole movie could kind of do without it. You could probably cut that scene out and it still live like within itself. I think.
Yeah, you don't need it, and it is by far the weakest thing in a very good movie.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that, the scene where they land on the planet itself, is really cool how they go in the pod and land on the planet and have to, like, take this, beryllium sphere or whatever, that's really cool. But, yeah, the rock, sort of character, I didn't really, of all the monsters that they're going to fight, like, it doesn't make any sense.
It's the least interesting one. Yeah. But yeah, but them landing on the planet is great. It's got another great little Sam Rockwell moment when Tony Shalhoub is about to open up the spaceship door. He's like, don't do that. Is there air? You don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just a little bit of logical thinking. Like he has a, because Guy is, Sam Rockwell's character is very much the voice of reason through a lot of this, and he's just so funny. And like Shalhoub is such a great straight man where he's like, seems fine.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just like where he's kind of the extra on the show or whatever, or the extra crewman or whatever. He's the one that has the most like real reactions, you know, of everything.
Yeah.
You know? He's the one like really freaking out and really showing his emotions and stuff like that. Yeah.
He's mostly terrified throughout the entire movie, pretty much.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But,
all right. So, but yeah, definitely a beloved, classic and a cult classic within itself. I absolutely, love Galaxy Quest. It's a great movie, and it was a great movie to watch again, you know?
So let's get into that trivia, man.
Okay, so I got just a little bit of trivia on Three Amigos. I told you Steve Martin, had this idea for Three Amigos back in 1980. He really originally had Bill Murray Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi as his other two cohorts. So they were tied to the project like early on. Of course, John Belushi passed away, and then so that kind of left things kind of up in the air. Then at one point, Steven Spielberg was tied to the project and had Bill Murray and Robin Williams as the other two, Three Amigos. But yeah, Steven Spielberg decided to do E.T. instead, which is probably a really great decision on Steven Spielberg's part. So
yeah, I can't really see either of those alternate casts either. I can't picture. Like sometimes you can picture what the movie be like with those people, but I can't picture Three Amigos at all with those people you mentioned.
Yeah. So Aykroyd became unavailable, and he suggested John Candy. So John Candy couldn't really fit on the horse and like do all this stuff because he's a pretty big guy. But so he said, "Well, hey, why don't you get this guy Martin Short? He's a great, great dude." And so they got Martin Short, and then if Martin Short didn't, sign on, they were going to go with Rick Moranis.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Which that I could see. I mean, obviously, I think Martin Short's better for the role, but I can see Rick Moranis playing Ned.
Right. And then John Candy went on to do, that year, he went on to do Armed and Dangerous instead, which we also talked about on the show.
It's all interconnected.
Interconnected. So, like I said, Landis was busy with Twilight Zone and Helicopter Crash, sort of defense. And so the studio heavily edited the film and submitted his final cut. He submitted a director's cut, and they, cut it down. And several scenes were removed. They are included on the Blu-ray release, including an alternate opening featuring the peaceful village of Santa Poco, kind of being rampaged upon by El Guapo, extended scenes of the Three Amigos at the studio mansion and backlot, and removed as a whole subplot involving an up-and-coming rival actress played by Fran Drescher from The Nanny. So,
yeah, and there's actually a remnant of her in the movie. Like when they're trying to break into the studio, they walk in front of a billboard.
Yeah,
and the billboard is actually of her, one of her movies.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
go ahead.
I've got the Blu-ray, and the deleted scenes owned it are pretty interesting, honestly.
I don't have the Blu-ray, but yeah, that would be interesting to see. Randy Newman is credited as a writer on this film, but mostly because he wrote the three songs for the movie that are sung, The Ballad of the Three Amigos, My Little Buttercup, and Blue Shadows. But Newman did not do the score. That was done by Elmer Bernstein.
And those three songs are a very big part of the film, if you think about it. So I can see why they gave Newman a writing credit. I mean, it's almost a musical. I mean, Three Amigos is very close to just being a straight-up musical.
Right. I mean, and when I say the ballad of the Three Amigos, it's, justice in there. Like, that's apparently, part of a song or whatever. So, all right. So the amount of money that was offered to the Three Amigos to come to Santa Poco was 100,000 pesos. The Mexican to U.S. dollar exchange rate would have been about a little over 2 pesos to $1 in 1920. So that would have been like $200,000. And that was in like 1920, which is a lot of money.
Yeah, the peso didn't really fall in value until the mid 90s.
Yeah.
You know, we often hear people make insensitive jokes about how little the peso is worth, but it's a fairly recent phenomenon that money has so little value now.
Yeah, because they changed from like the gold standard or the silver standard or something like that. But yeah, they were originally like silver coins, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So quick facts, El Guapo, you already mentioned in Spanish for the handsome one. The Cantina del Borracho is Spanish for bar of the drunk. And the bats that they're eating in the campfire scene is actually just bacon on a skewer. So, yeah. And you also mentioned that jefe in Spanish means boss, which is kind of like a tongue-in-cheek kind of joke. So that's really about it. I mean, the budget was estimated at $25 million, and the gross was $39 million.
So it was fairly successful, you know.
Fair, but you know, not a huge hit like you would think. Like, it's a very well known movie. I would think that it would gross like a lot more than that.
Well, it goes back to that it was just on TV all the time for people our age. You know?
Yeah, it's just it's a very sort of entertaining, just like fun watch movie. Roger Ebert, I don't even want to tell you what he rated it.
He hated it, huh?
1 star.
Well, I've said it before, I'll say it again. He's not always right.
He says, the ideas to make the three amigos into a good comedy are here, but the madness is missing. I don't really know what he means by that.
I'm not sure either.
I mean, maybe he was thinking some more outlandish stuff rather than it being more sort of PG-ish. So I don't know.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, I don't always agree with him, and this is one of those times.
Yeah, I mean, I know we don't like one scene in the movie, but that wouldn't tempt me. That may take away half a star, if that, you know what I mean? But seriously, like, take 1 star. Rotten Tomatoes, 46% critic score.
Yeah, I could see critics at the time not getting it.
Yeah. 67% audience. So, but here's the thing. It's ranked number 79 on Bravo's list of the 100 funniest movies. Okay?
It's got a following, man. I've never met anyone who's seen it who doesn't like it.
And do you know what's rated number 1 of the 100 funniest movies on Bravo's list?
I'm going to guess Blazing Saddles.
That one's up there, but another John Landis movie, Animal House.
Yeah, I find that surprising because I'm going to tell you, I'm not the biggest fan of Animal House.
I think we've talked
about it before. But,
I think, you know, it's just that era of critics think you have to go to college during that era for it to be kind of funny. But anyway, I'm not saying that it's not funny. I love Animal House too. I don't know if it's number one funniest movie ever, but anyway. More notes.
It's fine. Galaxy.
Yeah, it's you know. Galaxy Quest. Okay, so a lot of notes on this. It was writer David Howard's original script was titled Captain Starshine. He got the idea for the film while listening to Leonard Nimoy intro an IMAX film on an Americans in Space film and wondered what other Star Trek actors had to do to make ends meet. So producer Mark Johnson purchased the film for DreamWorks, but then had another writer, Bob Gordon, rewrite things a bit, since Gordon was a true Star Trek fan. So he wrote a lot of like the Star Trek kind of things like in the movie. He kept some of the humor from the original script, like the ship scraping on the side, like leaving the dock.
Yeah.
But added more dramatic moments, like when Nesmith had to admit the truth to the Theremins. So he added all of those like kind of human elements, the same sort of way that, you know, that Star Trek was itself, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where you had to write like those human things, even though it's a sci-fi movie, it's very much about the human experience. So that's why a lot of people say it's a, homage to in a Star Trek movie. But anyway, moving on. The studio wanted Harold Ramis to direct, and producer Mark Johnson wanted Dean Parisot to direct. Well, it was originally, it was Dean Parisot did direct it, but Ramis left the film because he wanted Alec Baldwin for the lead role, and he just was not believing in Tim Allen. Steve Martin and Kevin Kline turned it down. So, but he was, but you know, Harold Ramis was like, "Well, if Tim Allen's going to be the lead, I'm not doing this film." And I mean, and really, Tim Allen, you know, he was still, it was near the end of the TV show Home Improvement. It had been on for several years. He had done the Santa Claus movie, but he wasn't really a big Hollywood movie star. And he wasn't really,
really
seen.
Still not. Yeah. You know, I mean.
Exactly. He's done like this movie, and he's done like Buzz Lightyear. But, you know, he's not, you know, he's definitely not Steve Martin or Kevin Kline.
But honestly, I would love to see the Steve Martin version of that. I think it'd be really, I don't know if it'd be better, but it would really be interesting to see like Steve Martin in that role, you know?
Yeah. But after seeing the film, Harold Ramis said he was ultimately impressed with Allen's performance.
Well, so, at least he could admit that. So that's nice.
Yeah. I mean, and I think Allen's performance is great. I mean, I think that
he's good.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it fits the film. Let's just put it that way. Allen had to choose between this role and Bicentennial Man. So Bicentennial Man was played by Robin Williams. Allen always wanted to be a sci-fi actor. He said he based his motivation to play the role of Nesmith was based on Yul Brynner as Ramses II in The Ten Commandments rather than on William Shatner.
Well, I don't see that at all, but good for him. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Allen was such a fan of Sigourney Weaver. He was really kind of a fanboy and had her sign some of his alien memorabilia. So Weaver signed it, but she did a funny joke. She signed it, "Stolen by Tim Allen. Love, Sigourney Weaver." Which he apparently said he did not appreciate.
I don't know. That's pretty great. I don't know. I think that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I would think that was, you know, because, yeah, you have to think about it. Sigourney's like, really? Really? You want? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a faux pas, really.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, especially for yourself. At least you're getting something for you, like your Uncle Bill or something. You know, it's one thing, but you like your own memorabilia. Anyway, so Alan Rickman, he was not a big fan of sci-fi and never really wanted to do sci-fi movies, but he wanted to do this movie strictly for the comedy. Like, I think that he was, you know, he played Hans Gruber and he played some other things. He wanted to do like a funny movie. And so this one, he was like, okay, I could really get into this, you know, kind of British guy, you know, as like a serious actor or whatever. They also wrote, the writers wrote the "By Grathbar's Hammer, by the Sons of Warvan, you shall be avenged." That line was written as a temp line because they hadn't really figured out exactly what he was going to say. But, I mean, as they were practicing and doing everything, they said it, and then all the crew and everything started saying it, and then it just kind of stuck. So they're like, okay, we have to keep it now.
Sometimes that's how it goes, you know?
Yeah. So
happy,
I mean,
accidents.
Right. So if something catches on by just people being nearby, like, you know, you've got something like really cool, right? Tony Shalhoub originally auditioned for the Guy Flegman role, which is the crewman number 6, but was cast as Fred Kwan, is like the engineer. And he said he played I didn't even get this in the movie, and you can tell me if you got it. He played it as a kind of a stoner. And it was all based upon like David Carradine and Kung Fu, kind of like this idea that, like, you know, David Carradine was like, you know, on drugs a lot of the times in the scenes in Kung Fu because he was just like kind of standing around silently.
Yeah, I mean, I always picked up on it because throughout the entire movie, the character of Fred is completely unfazed by anything that happens in the entire movie.
Yeah.
Like, he's completely like, whatever, you know, if you have time, it's fine.
Right.
He's always just kind of mellow,
mm-hmm.
no matter what happens in any of the film.
Right.
And so, yeah, I always kind of picked up on that, but that's just me.
Yeah, I didn't really get on it until I read it. I was like, okay. But, yeah, I mean, there's so many crewmen and so many people in the movie. You're just trying to keep up with everything that's going on. But, yeah, I mean, even when the Theramans, like, reveal their true bodies, which looked like really weird, like, octopi or whatever, he's just like, huh, cool. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, he's tripping or something like that. Like, he's tripping on acid and just kind of there, you know?
It's like,
hey, one moment he's standing there pouring coffee. The next minute he's on like a ship seeing like, you know, weird aliens transform into people. He's like, cool. He's like,
that's a hell of a thing, you know?
It was Justin Long. Like I said, it's Justin Long's first film. He based his character on a combination of Philip Seymour Hoffman's Scotty J from Boogie Nights and the comic book guy from The Simpsons.
Huh.
So, and a lot of other actors were kind of up for that role, but I think that he really nailed it. And he really, really did, that role a lot of justice. I really loved his enthusiasm.
He feels very real in it, for sure.
Rainn Wilson's also first movie. It was fun to see him as a theremin, being a big, Office fan. And then the we didn't even talk about Missy Pyle. Playing Lalari, and they said that the casting director had a really hard time like finding a girl to play Lalari. So when they found when Missy Pyle auditioned, the casting director Deborah Zane sent the audition tape directly to director Pariseau with a note that read, "If this is not Lalari, I resign from the CSA or the Casting Society of America." So she's like, this is the girl. Steven Spielberg, because this was part of DreamWorks, so he was involved in like production. He's probably like the executive producer and all that kind of stuff. He actually had Lalari's role expanded as a love interest for Tony Shalhoub's character for Fred, because her role was so great. And really, if you think about it, the only other like female character is Sigourney Weaver. So.
It's true. Well, she has, so Missy Pyle's got a really unique presence in the film.
Mm-hmm.
She really seems like she really feels like an alien.
Mm-hmm.
Like she doesn't feel like an actor like playing a part. I mean, she really feels otherworldly.
Yeah, like she really doesn't understand what's going on, and she's really just kind of mirroring other things. She was almost like robotic, but like really kind of creepy. You know what I mean? Like just smiling and just had those. Really great, it was really good. The scene where Tim Allen's character overhears some people talking about, I already talked about that. Galaxy Quest was cut down. So this is another thing where the two movies that we did like have a weird sort of editing history. Okay. So this one was cut down from a rated R film down to PG. Did you know that?
You can tell in one scene, and the only reason I believe I didn't know that for sure, but you can tell in one scene. There's a scene where when they're going through the bowels of the ship, it's Sigourney Weaver and Tim Allen. They get to the part with like the crushing things and the flame,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she goes, "Well, screw that."
Yeah.
And if you look at her lips, she is very clearly not saying the word screw. She's saying the F word.
Well, apparently, it's funny that you mention that because Sigourney Weaver did have to overdub her line because she really did say, her character really did say, "Well, F that." And she had to go and overdub, "Well, screw that." And she states she purposely made her dubbed line state like it was, out of form of protest because she didn't want it to be changed. She didn't think it needed to be changed.
Yeah. Well, it's if that's always the one clue I had that they probably edited it down a little bit. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else they would have cut out to really change the tone, because it seems like it's not a very violent film. It's got stakes, but I mean it's not really harsh in any way.
I think that like where the scene where the ship comes in to land at the convention, there were some like people that were there that were decapitated and. It was just like much more gore. Oh, okay. I think there was much more gore and stuff like that. I think.
Yeah, I can see why they cut that out then, because that'd be really jarring.
Yeah, the scene where the alien guy like comes in and actually shoots everybody, that was apparently like a lot more gory. There was like more sort of like harsh language, just like that. But apparently the reason the decision was made to move the R film down to PG was that DreamWorks needed a movie to compete against Stuart Little and the Rugrats movie. So you have to move yourself back to like 1999, where, you know, DreamWorks gets like created, right? They've only been around for a few years and they're really trying to make their mark in this like new territory and like say, okay, we're trying to do stuff and compete against the Columbia Pictures and the Paramounts and, you know, the Sony Pictures and you know, we're one of the big guys, and they needed a movie to compete against Stuart Little and the Rugrats movie.
Which is funny in retrospect, because no one really talks about either of those two films, but a lot of people still revere Galaxy Quest.
Yeah. So writer Bob Gordon, he said he didn't make a family film, and okay, the other parts were DeMarco attempting to seduce aliens, in the crash, escape pod, decapitating. So yeah, it was really, really odd. In theaters, the first 20 minutes of the film were presented, and this is also like a movie nerd thing, so hopefully you'll appreciate this.
I do, because I've got kind of a story about this, but go ahead.
The first 20 minutes were presented in 1.85 to 1 aspect ratio before changing over to a wider 2.35 to 1 ratio when Nesmith looks out upon space as the Protector arrives at Thermia to maximize the effect on viewers. So basically it went from like widescreen to like super scope widescreen. And yeah, some of the theaters, they didn't have, they pull in the curtains on the side, and some of them didn't have like the curtains all the way out. And so like part of the film is being projected on the curtains.
Yeah. The intent was, like I said, the initial aspect ratio is actually, it starts off as 4:3 when they show the TV show. Then it goes to what we think of as like a widescreen television for like the first part of the film.
Yeah.
And then when they reveal that all of it's real and they're in space, it goes to the super wide widescreen like Lawrence of Arabia. And I actually saw it in the theater where they actually did convey that effect. Like when the reveal happens, when they open the doors and show you space, the intent was the curtains are supposed to open and you realize how wide the screen really is. And it's a pretty neat effect. And because when I saw it in the theater on the weekend it came out, my theater did that. And I remember it being blown away by the sudden change in scope, because I didn't expect it to happen. And it was a really cool effect. It gives you that feeling like how Tim Allen feels when he realizes he's in space. It's a really neat effect. But that effect is completely removed from the home video releases.
Yeah, I remember when it came out, I was in college and like a lot of us, like, you know, we're into movies and music, and some of the people that I went to, you know, college with were, you know, they were learning to do recording because they wanted to do, you know, film Foley work or whatever. And, you know, they talked about that, and there was even talk of possible like automation of the, you know, of the theater. Like, could we have a track on the film that could tell, you know, the aspect ratio and like when to open the curtains or something like that. But yeah, it was just kind of one of those things.
Yeah. Well, and I bring up the home video thing because for years I actually kind of thought I had imagined the change in aspect ratio. But recently I saw a little documentary on Twitter, and I'll share it on our official Twitter if I can remember to in 2 or 3 months when this comes out, where they talk about the change in the aspect ratio. And I was like, okay, I didn't imagine that. It actually did get wider in the theater, because, like I said, that effect's been completely removed in the home video release.
Yeah, that's really, really cool. That is really, really awesome. Yeah, I think it just stays in the same 16:9 aspect ratio the whole time.
Yes, it does.
They just cut off the sides. So anyway, to promote the film, before the release of the movie, a promotional mockumentary entitled Galaxy Quest 20th Anniversary, The Journey Continues, aired on E! So, they actually had like a sort of mockumentary thing where they're pretending that they're, you know, really being interviewed and really doing this like, you know, thing about the, and they, you know, show some of the same scenes that are in some of the movies, and they do, you know, mock interviews and stuff like that. So,
yeah, so sort of a fake behind the music kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and then one of the earliest films to have its own domain and website, galaxyquest.com. It was made to look like a fandom site with screen captures and poor HTML. Apparently, the site no longer exists, but you can see it if you go to the Wayback Archive. So just search for like Wayback Machine or something like that. Put in galaxyquest.com and you can look at what they built. But yeah, it was all for promotion. It was all, you know.
That's too bad, man, because, you know, the Space Jam website still exists. So it's sad that the Galaxy Quest one doesn't.
Well, I think only because DreamWorks doesn't. Well, I mean, I don't know if they pay for the domain, but, you know, paying for domains and having the servers up got, you know, really expensive the past 10 years or so, you know. Although an homage to Star Trek, the prefix for the Protector's registration number is NTE-3120, but NTE really stands for Not the Enterprise.
Nice.
Yeah. The budget for the movie was $45 million, and the box office, $90
million. It was a hit.
Yeah, I mean, it made double. It was nominated for several Saturn Awards, which Saturn Awards are from the Academy of Science Fiction since 1973, but it only won in one category, and that was for Best Actor to Tim Allen. So, but it was nominated for Best Science Film, Best Director, Best Actress, Best Supporting Actor, Best Special Performance by a Younger Actor for Justin Long, Best Music, Best Costume, Best Makeup, Best Special Effects. But this was also a year that, like, The Matrix came out, so...
Yeah, and nothing was beating The Matrix in 99.
Yeah. Roger Ebert gave it 3 stars.
Yeah.
So
and again, that's out of a 4-star scale. That's
out of 4.
Scale, so,
out of 4. He says, the humor works best when the illogic of the TV show gets in the way. So he really liked, you know, like the... You know, where he was like, oh, you know, the timer like stops on, you know, 10 seconds or something like that, or 1 second. It always stops, you know. It's like, oh, okay.
Like that's when it stops on the show. It stops at 1 second. Yeah.
Or like he really liked the scene where they're in the chompers bit. It's like, you know, why even have this? Oh, because, you know, they built it because it was on the TV show.
Yeah.
It's like, this is really stupid.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he really liked that part of it. Rotten Tomatoes gave it 89% critic score.
Yeah, I mean, it was it's always been a well thought of film.
But it's surprisingly enough, 79% audience.
Well, you know, I mean, not everyone appreciates Star Trek, you know?
Okay. November of 2019, a 1 hour and 35 minute documentary was released entitled Never Surrender, a Galaxy Quest Documentary.
Mm-hmm. Which is available on Amazon Prime if you have a Prime subscription. Which actually, that's my recommendation for this week, just to go ahead and jump to that.
I was surprised to look. I mean, when I was like looking on the IMDb notes, I was like, wow. I mean, that was just released like not too long ago at all. Yeah. Yeah.
It's brand new practically. So yeah, and it's if you have a Prime account, it's free to stream. It's a wonderful look at the film. It's feature length. I mean, pretty much everyone is interviewed who's available, and it's...
Yeah, Justin Long, Tim Allen, Sigourney Weaver. I mean, they're all in it. I mean, Alan Rickman, unfortunately, that's one of the reasons why a sequel was never done, because of his unfortunate passing. But yeah, I really want to watch this documentary now.
Well, with Amazon Prime, you can.
Yeah, if you have Amazon Prime. It is available to rent... from Amazon Prime, also from Google Play, YouTube, Apple TV, or it's also available to stream for free if you have History Vault.
Interesting. I did not know that.
So, it already has a 7.6 rating on IMDb. I mean, already. So
it's a good documentary. I watched it back when it first came out, and I'm probably going to rewatch it now since we've...
Oh, really?
Went back and rewatched this, yeah.
So you knew it was going to come out, like you were anticipating, and you watch it, and okay,
yeah,
wow. Well, that is really, really cool. You know, I don't think we have to do the, you know, return or keep, because I think, yeah. I mean, judging on our comments, yeah, we're going to keep both of these, right? Keep it an extra day.
These are the ones where you steal them from the video store and hope they don't notice.
Exactly. You know? Like, oh, yeah. I'll take Three Amigos back sometime, like, you know, whatever.
Yeah, that's what you rent it from a store in a different town and then just never go back. Yeah,
but it's one of those movies that you just kind of like have around, like, you know, watch on like a late, you know, Saturday night at like, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning or something. Like, oh, we'll watch this. Oh, yeah, this is great. Yeah. You know, anyway.
Yeah, they are perfect lazy watches. You know, they're good, great for any time. We just want to have some fun and relax. Mm-hmm. Both are perfect for that.
I'm going to do my suggestion first because it's a real easy one. My sort of, suggestion, you know, as a video store clerk, is a movie that I've recommended before, called Spies Like Us, mm-hmm. that stars Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase. And I think it kind of plays with the same idea of like, you know, we're doing something important, but we're really kind of faking it as we're going along. And I think it falls in line with the same humor as like the Three Amigos. And it's hard to find a movie like Galaxy Quest. I'll be quite honest. It's very unique in that respect for sure. But yeah, Spies Like Us is you know, fantastic movie. It's kind of in the, you know, the middle of the Cold War. But you have these two kind of like, you know, vagabond type of characters, I guess you would say, that just kind of find each other and bumble their way through, you know, trying to outsmart the Russians, you know?
Yeah, there's not a lot of films like it. I'll tell you one movie that besides the documentary about Galaxy Quest, which again is called Never Surrender, which I recommend. Another film that I think kind of would work with Three Amigos is Billy Crystal's City Slickers.
Yeah,
you know, it's a comedy western. It's about guys who are in over their heads a little bit with a western adventure. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not quite the same story, mm-hmm. but it's still a lighter comedy, mm-hmm. with western tropes. And if you like Three Amigos, you'd probably like to see City Slickers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're really trying to pretending that they're real cowboys, and they can do this kind of thing, they kind of go on this cattle drive, as in like an adventure, right? They bought an adventure with this guy that's going to take them on this real travel guide, cause they're like New York City, you know, guys or whatever. And then they wound up dying on the trail. And then, they have, you know, they make the decision, you know, in the middle of it, like, well, we're going to complete what we started, you know what I mean? And try to get it done.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's got a similar vibe. So I think that would make a good. I think it'd make a good double feature with Three Amigos.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I also, you know, kind of, I you know, watching Three Amigos just took me back to like Nacho Libre and stuff like that too. Like, you know, just how kind of silly the bad guys are, and kind of being in a small town in Mexico and stuff like that. Definitely a different kind of movie, but. But either which way, I think that they're. I don't know if we can say anything more about either of these two movies. I really just enjoy both of them.
Except that, yeah, they're both highly recommended. I mean, I think that they're movies that personify what we enjoy about comedies. That they're two movies that couldn't be any more video culture movies to us.
Yeah, even if we had scenes that we would say that we would take out if we were the director, but you know, hey, not everything's perfect, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, but you know, you can love something and still recognize its flaws,
right?
And I definitely love these movies, mm-hmm. and I think that about does it for this episode. I guess we'll see you guys again in 2 weeks, and in 2 weeks we're going to be talking about two films. About the 80s, but they're about the 80s in very different ways.
Yes.
And all I'll say is, greed is good.
Yeah. That's one of the lines, I think.
Yeah, that's one of the lines.
All right, well... Yeah, go ahead.
And I can't really repeat a line from the other movie without completely giving it away.
No, I mean, and completely horrible lines. I do know that there's a soliloquy about the band Genesis. Let's just put it that way. All right, that says about enough. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Estrey. Go watch some movies, guys.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, come hang out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
In the far reaches of the galaxy, a civilization is under siege.
We are all that is left.
They've searched the universe for a leader.
Stay tuned for scenes from next week's Galaxy Quest.
Never give up. Never surrender.
He will save us.
What they got.
Never give up. And never surrender.
Were struggling TV actors.
You are our last hope.
Where's my limo?
Okie dokie.
And they're about to put on a command performance 8 million light years away.
We are actors, not astronauts.
You are our protectors.
That was a hell of a thing.
Now,
Laredo, take us out.
You gotta move to the right.
Would you sit your ass down? You wanna drive this to...
Acting like heroes.
The whole thing was just a misunderstanding.
May not be enough.
They look like little children. Hi, little guy.
Oh, darn.
DreamWorks Pictures presents Tim Allen, Sigourney Weaver, Alan Rickman. Galaxy Quest.
You're just gonna have to kill him.
Well, go for the mouth, the throat, his vulnerable spots.
It's a rocket, doesn't have any vulnerable spots.